strings, 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 strings. In honor of Get Out, what's the tensest you've ever felt in a movie during a specific moment?
I'm Katie Rich, and everyone who listens to this podcast knows that it doesn't take much to make me feel tense or scared in a movie, but I do clearly remember seeing Apollo 13 in theaters when I was 11 and feeling so nervous during, you know, the various try to save the spaceship scenes that I had my feet crunched up against the seat in front of me and I was like curled up in the fetal position, and it was thrilling and terrifying.
Hey, it's me, David the Seven, and as I get older, things like the Prometheus squid C-section scene are making me more tense than the classics, like the way the Big Bad Wolf does camera takes in the original Disney animated Three Little Pigs.
I am Matt Patches, and actually most recently I was scared and tense during an eel-heavy scene in the movie The Cure for Wellness, which is really good, but I assume that we did not talk about it last week on the podcast, but
no, we did not.
You should see that movie. But the one that still resonates and has me thinking in this is the opening of Inglourious Basterds with Colonel Landa and going into that hut and sitting over. Are they drinking milk? I believe they're drinking milk.
I think they're drinking
scene.
Milk.
Maybe that's why I haven't drank milk since then.
And I'm David Ehrlich, and just for lack of better options, I think I'm going to go with something that we've discussed at length on this podcast before, and cite the nude sewer run in Ben Wheatley's Kill List. I just remember sitting there next to my good friend Matt Patches as these naked, crazy cult members came running towards the screen and feeling like they were going to pop through it and murder me.
Gentlemen, you can't fight in here. This is the war room.
Fine, I can hear you now, Dimitri. Clear and plain and coming through fine. I'm coming through fine too, eh? Good, then. Well, then, as you say, we're both coming through fine. Good. Well, it's good that you're fine and I'm fine. I agree with you. It's great to be fine.
It's a podcast. Hello and welcome to Fighting in the War Room, episode 155. It's Tuesday, February 21st, 2017. But on this day in 1970, holy cow, the Jackson 5 made their American Bandstand debut. And, you know, pop music was never the same. It's a good on this day. I'm going to get right to it because we have a lot of contests to announce. That's the kind of podcast we've become where we have contests, which is amazing. I am delighted by it. It's just like a funny, officially sounding thing. First of all, wait, Patches, did you want to do the new reviews first, or did you want to talk about the runners-up from the first contest?
Why don't we do the runners-up from the first contest, because I can see a good segue here. So we were giving away posters and fun goodies related to this year's Oscars, and I think we announced a winner the last time I was on this show. Our good listener, Cyrus, he has messaged me, and I just need to mail him some stuff. But there are two runner-up prizes, and I finally figured out who those are going to, because I have time to live and breathe and read. And those are going to listeners Madison Vilkin and Zach Ford. I think you both commented on our Facebook page, so you should message us via Facebook and send us your addresses, and I will put those in the mail eventually. Yes, soon, ASAP.
No promises on dates.
I don't want to sound like I'm on top of this, but I don't want to sound like I've forgotten about it.
It'll
either.
Be a so,
what did they do to win?
They recommended quarter quill ideas.
Ah.
And very good quarter quill ideas. And maybe we'll use them in the future. Who knows?
Yeah, we can always use good ideas.
But yeah, so I'll be sending all posters for La La Land, Manchester by the Sea, Jackie, I think. I can't remember. But posters will go in the mail soon. And we have a second contest that we're doing. I don't know why we're doing so many contests, but it's like an ad, but it gives you something instead. No, it's not an ad. We want to give people Blu-rays. Yes, we're giving away three bundles of Oscar-related Blu-rays. We have Moonlight, Manchester by the Sea, Hell or High Water, and Hacksaw Ridge. We have three bundles of those four movies, and we want to give them to you. Katie, how are we giving them away?
So we want you either, if you have not left us a review on iTunes, leave us a review. It's high time to do that. And if you already have, you can still enter. You can convince someone else to leave us a review. And if they mention you in their review, you both get entered to win. So it's kind of a win-win situation. And also a note on that bundle. I intend to never watch Hacksaw Ridge again for the rest of my life, but that's still a really good deal. Moonlight and Manchester by the Sea would be great Blu-ray show.
Hacksaw Ridge is not a bad movie.
No,
it's
interesting movies.
It's
a lot of blood.
A lot of blood. People can win those.
Either leave a review or convince someone else to do it.
And that should segue perfectly into reading our reviews from this week. That's what I
was
thinking.
Yeah.
Oh, that was the masterful segue you had.
I thought Katie was going to make it a little more elegant, but
hey, I can only do so much around here.
I don't want to place blame. David?
Well, we have a couple of new reviews here. We also, if you're listening out there over the sea, or across the sea rather, met somebody at a screening at the Berlin Film Festival who mentioned that he had left a review in our UK store, so we are going to make a point to take a peek, as we sometimes do, at our international store reviews. So if you're out there and you left a review for us in another, ideally English language speaking or English language format from another country.
But we can get translations.
We can get translations. But we should, in the spirit of me reading these by the seat of my pants, we should do very, very shitty translations. like the tweet deck translations that I get from tweets that come in. Okay, but we have a few. Last week, did you guys read this review by Raven Mask about Katie Rich not being suspended from SNL?
Oh, no, I don't think so.
That was February 6th. No? Okay.
I don't believe so.
In that case, we have three reviews. And we'll begin with Raven Mask, who says, Katie and the Roomettes. Katie Rich, so glad she wasn't suspended from writing for SNL.
True.
Needs an entertaining roundtable podcast about TV, movies, and pop culture. While I usually enjoy each week's episode, sometimes I wish it had a greater variety of viewpoints and more Joanna. Regardless, it is time well spent and worth your consideration.
More Joanna is a common refrain in these reviews.
What does it mean?
I'll never know.
Mass Differ says, better late than never. Longtime Storm of Spoilers listener that finally took Dave up on his Fighting in the War Room plug, now binging to catch up. That's good.
Good. Yeah, that's a good way to do it.
Very exciting.
And finally, this week's featured review, if we have such a thing, just by sheer virtue of its girth, comes from Old Man Logan M., who calls us, in the spirit of a review a few episodes ago that compared us all to the Justice League, this is the X-Men of podcasts.
Mm.
To explain who you are, I must explain how you came to be. Long ago, I was a loner and veteran of conflicts, lost and trying to find out my next purpose. I began consuming podcasts. Began with podcasts based on my biggest interests at the time, movies and television. Based on two podcasts unrelated to yours, We Hate Movies and The Night's Watch, the algorithm suggested The Tobolowsky Files and Cast of Kings, both David Chen podcasts that I enjoyed. As I listened to them, I was quickly persuaded to follow one Joanna Robinson over to Fighting in the War Room. Despite the many changes in my life since the beginning of the podcast journey 5 years ago, I have felt most comfortable with your podcast. I listened to all the discussions, and because I can't get enough, began actually using my Twitter more actively to hear more and interact with you all. So, on to the comparisons to the X-Men. David is Cyclops, Scott Summers. He is confident in his views and sets himself as a de facto leader of the group. I don't usually get that. It's usually reserved for Katie. But it's uptightness. Oh. Especially when it comes to popcorn fare and pretentiousness when it comes to Oscar bait, stay tuned for that, makes him a natural antagonist to me, even when we agree mostly. Everything else, especially politics. Patches is Colossus, Peter Rasputin. He is overgrown oaf, quite good-natured. He is jovial and happy in most of the podcasts, but when he feels passionate about a subject, there is power and shockwave that is unmatched. Dave is Nightcrawler, Kurt Wagner. He is jovial and carefree with a swashbuckling nature to his views. He's able to banff from serious to pop culture to humor with ease. But just like that blue elf, there are deep-held beliefs and honor that make him a serious and good man beneath the jokes. Katie is Phoenix Jean Grey. She commands the room with her presence. While giving a motherly vibe to the war room, she is also one of the most powerful. Especially after the election, it was Katie's Phoenix-level fire of passion, strength, and resolve that managed to move to not despair. And while David may set himself as the leadership, it is Katie who truly leads and controls the show. As far as guests, Jordan is Iceman, Bobby Drake, good-natured and funny little brother of the team, even though, parentheses, he's older than all of us, always ready to slide in, throw some snowballs, make some quips, and leave when the time is done. Joanna Robinson is Storm or Roro Monroe. She comes to the show bringing the powers of her code name and care of a woman who is both common and regal. Much like the real Storm, she is strong enough to lead her own group of X-Men, and often does. Keep up the great work. I waited until I finally had concise thoughts to give you this 5-star review. Now let's continue entertaining while we secretly fight a world that fears and hates us, or at least the conservative half of it. There are evil mutants to fight. Look no further than our own White House.
Aye.
We live up to Charles Xavier's dream to find peace between us all and work to bring a better world. Well said.
Wow.
I like that
review.
You pronounced Jean Grey, Jean Grey.
He's been in Europe, didn't he?
Oh, Jean Grey. Beautiful man.
that is a wonderful review. You do not have to leave reviews that long, but please leave them that thoughtful. It's really delightful to hear.
If you want to leave them that long, that's okay too.
Please do. Yeah, David will read them. Yeah, so leave reviews. Get your friends to do it. Enter our contest. There's lots of good reasons to do so.
Da, la, 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 la.
Bam. So, I have returned from Japan, where that's why I missed the podcast last week. I was on my honeymoon in Japan, where I was learning about a whole different world. Actually, Japan, Tokyo, and New York, they're not too far apart. Do you think, David? David's been there many times, and he recommended places for me to go. And so he's a seasoned Japan.
They are, and they aren't. It's not the kind of place where you get off the plane and feel like you were flying to Australia. Like, oh, I'm in Stamford, Connecticut. No, it feels very much like stepping into another world, but I think the speed at which it moves is similar to New York.
And as to prep myself for what I would experience in Japan, I tried to find a film on my 13-hour plane ride to Tokyo out of snowy Newark that would acclimate me to.
You flew directly
Japanese.
From Newark to Tokyo?
I did, and I barely made it out because of our big snowstorm, but I thankfully did. Yeah, 13 hours. It's a bear of a flight, which when you're drugged up doesn't seem as long, but I won't get into that. Anyway, I want to talk about a film that I saw on my way to Japan called Your Name. This movie is gigantic. It is a huge hit in Japan. It is the second largest gross for a domestic Japanese film, just behind Spirited Away. It's the fourth biggest film in Japan ever, behind Titanic and Frozen. And it's actually why I think it blew up last year when it came out in August 2016, is because, you know, Studio Ghibli was fading and Miyazaki had retired, and people, and I'm kind of gleaning this all from reading about the film after the fact, but people wondered if prestigious anime would continue as a blockbuster culture in Japan after Miyazaki retired, and clearly it did. I mean, this movie is the first anime not directed by Miyazaki to earn more than $100 million dollars, American U.S. dollars, at the Japanese box office. So it's huge, huge, huge. And you go around Tokyo, and I was also in Kyoto, so I saw glimpses of it there, just how far this movie has trickled down into culture. And I think it'll become evident when we start talking about the movie, but every toy store, every cafe, all over the place, all over the city, you see glimpses of Your Name iconography in toys, everywhere you could plaster the faces of the main characters in Your Name, you see them in Japan. It's kind of amazing. So it has swept the nation and is eventually coming to North America territories. Funimation is putting it out on April 7th here. So we will probably sing a few of its praises right now. I believe, David, you reviewed it for IndieWire and liked it. But we'll get there in a second. So what the film is about... It's actually a body swap movie. It's a very, very simple, fun, playful movie. Yeah, it's a body swap movie.
I like
movie.
A body swap movie.
Everyone loves a goofy, crazy body swap movie. But this one packs a little bit more of a punch. So it's about, first we meet this girl, Shuta, who lives in a rural town of Itomori, and her family tends to a shrine. I think she's raised by her grandmother. She has a little sister. She just dreams of living the big city life in Tokyo. And then there's a high school boy. I think he's in high school. They have a weird, there's a lot of things that I could probably stand to understand more about Japanese culture and why this kid seems like he could be in community college, but all the writing about it claims he's a high schooler. You were going to weigh in there?
No, I think he's in high school.
I think he is. Yeah. So his name is Taki, and he works a part-time at a restaurant, which is where we see most of his life. But he's kind of a wayward soul. He kind of has the hots for a girl he works with, but he's not very proactive. He's a goofball. He's just kind of floating by. He lives in Tokyo, so he lives the high life in a way. And, you know, lo and behold, there's a celestial event. I kind of think it's like pre-comet activity. There's a comet coming in soon, and This is
sure.
something that
Who hasn't before. Had a body swap when the comet came?
Yes, of course. With something in the universe is happening, and
oh
these
God.
Two
Could
start
snapping.
These two start snapping between each other's lives, waking up, and of course, because Taki is a high school boy, he spends most of his time groping his female breasts at the beginning, wondering what being a woman is all about. It's very peculiar. But there's
and how old is the girl he swaps his body into?
Who is the girl?
How old is she?
She's also in high school.
Oh, they're the same age. Okay,
yeah,
okay.
Yeah.
I was thinking like a child.
The same age. She might be like a year or two younger.
Okay.
But yeah, these are people who need to be awakened in this way, and they have a radical change, and they start living each other's lives and screwing up each other's lives. They definitely have a clash of personalities, and yeah, they and the direction from Makoto Shinkai. I haven't seen many of his movies. David, have you seen any of his previous work?
Oh, I have seen all
of
his previous
okay.
work.
He has this hyper-realism thing that still can be very energetic and colorful and playful and dynamic. How does that compare to his other work?
I mean, his work is as stylistically uniform as Miyazaki's. I mean, you would be able to compare a frame from this, even though there are some minor differences in his technique over the years. I mean, he burst onto the scene because he made a short film called Voices from a Distant Star, essentially by himself in his garage or whatever, bedroom, whatever the case may have been. It was a 25-minute film that established all of his interests that you can see play out in Your Name. It's about a boy and a girl who, Interstellar actually, jacked a lot from Voices from a Distant Star. A boy and a girl meet in high school, and then she goes off to fight an interplanetary war, and they send emails to each other, but she doesn't age because of where she is, and he does, and the emails take longer and longer and longer to get to one another, and it's this very bittersweet love story.
It sounds
story,
like it
and,
has some connections to
oh,
Your
yeah.
Name quite a bit.
Oh, yeah.
Well, I don't want to spoil too much this movie because it hasn't yeah. come out in America yet, but, you know, they have this body swapping thing, and of course they're kind of falling for each other at the same time. They're writing each other notes. You know, Taki will scribble in his notebook so that Michuta will see it the next day that she swaps into his body. So it's not a typical, it's not like Freaky Friday or something where it's a permanent swap until they can magically figure it out. Or like the change up where they need to pee in the same fountain again.
Is it like the lake house?
There's elements of the lake house. Yeah, so what happens, they start swapping bodies, and then the swapping stops. And that's when the movie takes kind of this radical change about how they'll reconnect, and if they're even in the same, on the same plane of existence. I don't want to get too spoiler about it, but it has some pretty grand ideas to go along with this super bubbly, flirtatious teen romance. Totally G-rated, but... It's an affecting film. And David, I'm curious about what you think about this, because obviously it was a huge, huge hit in Japan. And I'm wondering what you think about it makes it so popular or so transcendent for people. Because I'm watching it on a plane. I still think the visuals are amazing. Even, you know, just seeing the landscapes of Japan represented in different ways and clashing together, and just Shinkai's eye for kind of flipping back and forth between the body swapping stuff. And then it takes this left turn, and there are elements of the Fukushima accident and the tsunami, and this kind of a topic that we've seen a lot in Japanese film, even when we're talking about the American Godzilla or something like that. It's still haunting these images, and maybe that has something to do with it. But that's still, it's a super bubbly movie, and it's kind of slight in that way. You know, it's boys groping breasts, and it's so goofy to be in a girl's body sometimes. And dating culture, there's probably elements of Japanese dating culture that I don't understand, that I'm not really connecting to like some people would. You know, Taki dates, he wants to date the substantially older coworker of his at the restaurant that he works in. I don't really understand that. Maybe she's not that much older than he is. You'll have to clarify for me. And then, you know, there's all these like pop song interludes, which feel very Japanese, very anime, and I kind of fade, you know, I kind of check out during those moments. But there's something to this movie that's emotionally resonant that completely unhinges in the end. It's just a radical shift in where this movie goes in terms of its kind of sci-fi ideas. But I don't know why it's such a big deal culturally.
I'm not the guy to be able to tell you. I don't know. I do think that you're definitely right on the money to point out how it taps into a lot of Japan's recent trauma. And I think that there is a, in Makoto Shinkai's style, there is sort of baked into it this really melancholy sentimentality that works very strongly for some people, I think, at its most potent and its most sort of unreserved and direct in his previous movies, like 5 Centimeters Per Second and The Place Promised Us in Our Early Days. It's a little bit stronger. I struggle with this movie a little bit because I think that it just trips over itself. There's just too much going on that I think is needless and doesn't really add up. And I think that the bluntness, the power of its emotional bedrock is sort of lost in the various narrative gambits that it creates for itself, but it is still an effective and well-done and beautiful story. His animation is always gorgeous, always looks... It's like anticipated Instagram, that aesthetic. It's hyper-saturated. It's everything is always at the perfect hour. The skies and the colors of everything that you see here are so expressive, so vivid. I don't know why this movie has exploded so much, but
now that
I do think that it hits across a wide variety of demographics.
Hearing you talk about the visuals a little more, I'm sitting here thinking about my trip to Japan and just, you know, we think about Miyazaki, and I find his work very rustic, hearkening back to a fairy tale time, something older, even in its modern mode. And the filmmaking in Your Name feels extremely modern, even though it's dealing with past and present. And that's what I felt like my trip to Japan was all about, going to Tokyo, but visiting shrines, you know, ancient shrines in the middle of the city or just on the outskirts. This collision of past and present is happening at all times. When I visited Kyoto, you have a lot of Japanese people coming to visit the city and renting kimonos and visiting the shrines because they want to throw back to their own heritage and relive this kind of ancient history of Japan, or not even that ancient, just like tradition. And that's what I think this movie successfully does, captures the old in a totally new 2017 sheen. And that makes Shinkai totally distinct from Miyazaki and maybe the future of prestigious anime in Japan. Who knows? This was a huge hit.
Shinkai's entire career has been defined by these proclamations that he is the next Miyazaki, and finally, at least financially, that seemed to come to bear with Your Name. I do think he still has a little ways to go to have the cultural impact. I mean, you were the one who was just there, not I, but I think you can also probably see in your time there the depth to which that Miyazaki's characters, Totoro especially, is everywhere there. It's like a big part of the
I did buy a few culture. Totoro plush dolls while I was there.
I don't think Makoto Shinkai is quite there yet, but maybe 3 or 4 movies down the line, if he continues to have that sort of seismic impact, he could be. But if you're at all interested in any of this stuff, you should definitely keep an eye out for Your Name in April.
Well, hopefully this comparison is not the M. Night Shyamalan as the next Spielberg timing.
Yeah. Well, we're not going to put him on the cover of Time.
No.
Is there any reason to believe that Your Name could be, I mean, even as popular as Spirited Away was here? Like, anime movies don't obviously have the same impact here that they do in Japan.
I do not see it having the same cross.
It's too ingrained in Japanese culture, I think.
Yeah,
but it is coming out in North America, April 7th, 2017. You can watch it then.
All right. From one access country to another, we made this joke last week too. David, you were in Germany.
I am marrying this joke. My half German, half Japanese fiance. Referred to in my family as the axis of evil. Yes.
You don't mean that my joke is so good you want to marry it? I understand.
No, I do not mean that.
Yeah, David, we devoted a mini segment to this because from what I heard, it wasn't much of a Berlin, but you were there.
I was there indeed. Yeah, it was not a particularly thrilling Berlin. The only other time I'd been to Berlin, I had not gone to Sundance that year, and because Berlin cherry picks a lot of the best movies from Sundance, I think it may have felt like a richer festival experience just because of that alone. And this year, I had already... The talk of Berlin this year, without a doubt, was Call Me By Your Name, which was the biggest movie out of Sundance. And so it's two festivals in short order I'd been to that had been dominated by the same film. And so I definitely felt a little bit of restlessness as a result of that. Although it was nice to see Alex Ross Perry's Golden Exits get a warmer reception over in Europe, because I like that film. But yeah, Berlin was touch and go this year. It's sort of, it's a very, very big festival. So my experience, anyone's experience there, really just the tip of the iceberg. And because I was doing a lot of writing, and because I was so tired, and because of everything else, I really saw fewer movies than I tend to. But the ones that you should hear about just to know for future, are, one that you will definitely see on these shores is called Final Portrait. It's directed by Stanley Tucci. It is about a guy named James Lord. It's a true story set in Paris in 1964. James Lord was a hanger-on in the art world who was later a writer. He would write about his experiences, and he was friends with, Giacometti, the artist, sculptor, painter, who's played here by Jeffrey Rush, in a performance that is like a less manic, very affected shine. And he sits for a portrait by Giacometti, but Giacometti's a perfectionist, and he throws it out every day, and it becomes this very trying experience over the course of 18 days of as he keeps delaying his flight home. James Lord is played by Armie Hammer, who's the star of Call Me By Your Name. He's having a banner year. He's also great in Kill List, Free Fire by Ben Wheatley, same director. And this movie is very breezy. It's like, it feels like a vintage Woody Allen movie. It just sort of starts where it starts with some voiceover, lots of jazz. It ends where it ends. It goes on. It has some hidden depths to it, but, it's strong stuff. And I mentioned it because it'll play here. The best film I saw at the festival was the new Aki Kaurismäki film, his follow-up to Le Havre from 2011. It is the second film in his very loosely tied together and purely thematically port trilogy. And it's called The Other Side of Hope, which is a very alluring title these days. And is very similar to Le Havre, if you saw that. It's that same deadpan Finnish wit. Another story of a refugee, this time a young Syrian man who washes up ashore in Finland and seeks asylum and is denied, eventually escapes from where they're holding him, meets up with a guy who's sort of a refugee from his own life in a much less urgent way, a local Finnish man who leaves his wife in a hilarious scene and that opens the film, and starts a restaurant, and he hires the immigrant. And it's just sort of about the, like all Kaurismäki films to a certain degree, about the community they build. But it's a really, really good version of what Kaurismäki does. It could have done well for itself. But it didn't. It was here. I was happy for it. Another one is called A Fantastic Woman by Sebastian Lelio from Chile, who made Gloria a few years ago, which had a little bit of a splash year. And Sony Pictures Classics already bought this movie, so it will be on these shores by the end of the year. It is one of the best movies I've seen about a trans person, especially because what I found interesting about it was, as much as I love Tangerine is part of a long history of movies about trans people that fit their stories into genre, that need genre elements in order to give them a comfortable home, that are struggle to approach and depict trans people the same way that you would pretty much anyone else. And A Fantastic Woman, which is about a young trans woman whose partner, who's an older man who nobody knew was in a relationship with a trans woman, dies suddenly. And she just essentially has to negotiate learning, like the process of her late partner's family learning of her existence and learning what it says about the guy who died and dealing with, like, do I go to the funeral, whatever. And of course, everyone in the family it's a movie because most of them are rather bigoted, what's interesting about the movie is how it keeps flirting with these genre elements. It flirts with being like a Tarantino like revenge thriller almost at times, and it flirts with going full Fassbender or Almodovar, but it always sort of returns to this very humane center. I think it's effective because of that. And the last movie, there are a few others that were very bad. The Sally Potter movie, The Party, was very bad, and Trudy Styler made a movie called Freak Show that she adapted from a popular YA book of the same name that doesn't quite work, but is another sort of movie that explodes the gender binary in an interesting way. But the last one I'll talk about quickly is just the one that won, which is called On Body and Soul, and is a Hungarian movie about these two people who work in an abattoir, and they, in their dreams, they are deer, and they share the same dream, and they see each other in their dreams. And it's sort of about, the one's an older man, and one is a woman who is young and pretty, but on the spectrum, and is very difficult to relate to other people because of that. And they connect in their dreams and sort of fall in love. It's a nice movie. I don't know.
An abattoir. Lord.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. There's grisly footage of cows being cut apart. And yeah, but it's a strongly empathetic movie. And that is really just the closing thought here, is what this year's festival, I guess when you see 14 movies out of however many hundred, it's easy to tell your own story. But my feeling was that, given where the world is right now, to go to a festival that's as internationally, as aggressively international as this one is, that's as inclusive, and is sort of a warm embrace for filmmakers all over the world. I mean, much more so even than Cannes, and to a degree Toronto. I mean, you see movies from everywhere, Berlin. It did feel like the movies that put forward empathy, whether in the most abstract terms, like in On Body and Soul, or very literally in terms of our modern world, as you see with the refugee crisis in The Other Side of Hope, that empathy was sort of the call of the day. And so it was an interesting experience.
Did you feel that outside of the movie's narratives themselves? I'm just thinking, you mentioned The Other Side of Hope, which is about Syrian refugees, some almost like literal, in ripped from the headlines kind of stuff. And I'm wondering what the pulse of the festival is, just even in Berlin itself, maybe the pulse of Berlin terms of the
world.
Well,
there's no, as Diego Luna said, and I interviewed him, I had a quick Q&A with him, you can find it on IndieWire.com. But he was one of the jurors there, and he said that he was there to investigate how to tear down walls. And of course, he said that because Berlin has a rich history in that tradition.
There was a wall there?
Oh, yeah.
There was a wall. The wall was real news. And
interesting.
There are, you can see for yourself, there are slabs of the wall dotted around at least the center of the city where I spend most of my time. And yeah, I mean, everyone there fucking hates Trump. Of course they do.
Well, I asked because, yeah, in Japan, I spoke to many people about Abe, their prime minister, meeting with Trump, and they're all laughing at us. They just think it's so, they think it's funny, I think, right now. They're not scared in Japan.
I will say, and this will take a segment a little bit beyond the time we allotted for it, but I think it's important. I went to Hiroshima on an anniversary of August 6th, the bombing, a few years ago. And I was overwhelmed by the spirit there, which was not at all. I mean, it wasn't shame or certainly not defensiveness. It was really this incredibly beautiful spirit of, we were a part of this history, of the nuclear history. We play a irrevocable role in that. And we need to do everything in our power to make sure that it never comes to this again. There are no more nukes. There are certainly no more cause to use them. And it was a really inspiringly hopeful situation. And I feel like, given Germany's history and a similar conflict, that there was a similar, if less acute, feeling in Berlin in February of 2017, where they're less able to laugh at it, maybe than some other countries might, because as comical a figure as Donald Trump is, they are still very much in touch with what happened there, what came out of their country. And I think that they see the seeds of it. And it's a very comfortably anti-Trump environment. And although one weird aside is, I saw a movie there finally where somebody made in like jest a good German reference. They're like, I don't want to be a good German. The audience laughed hysterically, which was strange. I think that the festival, the spirit you got at the festival, I felt throughout the city in the limited time I spent traveling around there, they want no part in the sequel of this.
One quick note on Good German, for reasons that are not worth explaining, I saw the movie Pearl Harbor in Germany, and there's a line in the beginning where someone like yells, like, you're just like a nasty German, and they left really hard.
Wow.
It's hilarious. So I agree with everything David said about Germany remembering its history, but somehow, like, when it comes to World War II jokes about them, they're ready to laugh.
I think it's the laugh of recognition.
Of course, yeah.
You see, like, big Hollywood movies that call out, I mean, Germany doesn't all feel catered to, I would imagine, even though they're a huge country. So you go and see you know, if I went and saw like the new Michael Bay movie and they were like Greenwich, Connecticut, I would laugh no matter what they were saying. And they would probably be saying something negative because those are the only kinds of things you can say about Greenwich. So, yeah, I don't really think I hold it against them. I just thought it was interesting.
Yeah, it's been a long time since I've been back to the world. Welcome to Hollywood, the home of secrets and lies. We are coming to you from the Shrine, the only theater in America not showing one of the Star Wars movies. But it's great to be back here at the show, or as it's known this year, Sundance by the Sea. Things are a little different this year. It's a little different since the last time I was here. Back then, there was war in Bosnia and peace in the rap music industry. Back then, I thought Bruno Mali was the star of Il Postino. And back then, and the weirdest one of all, the major studios were nominated for Oscars. It was a strange time. This year, as you know, only one out of 163 major releases, Jerry Maguire, is nominated for Best Picture. One out of 163 major releases. 164 if you count Michael Ovitz. That's a different thing.
So I somehow talked everyone into letting me do a segment on the Oscars. As you probably know, I have a whole other podcast called Little Gold Men where we talk about the Oscars every week. You would think I'd be out of things to say, but I don't get to talk to you guys about the Oscars. And I think after Carol, David's been so burned on it that he has to be dragged kicking and screaming into this segment at all. But maybe to ease our La La Land fatigue or talk about something that everyone hasn't been hearing about, I thought it'd be fun to look back at the Oscar ceremonies that were 10 years ago and 20 years ago, because I think, especially this year, I'm expecting a lot of political speeches. I'm expecting a lot of what this Oscar winner means about our times. You know, there's already the talk about La La Land representing the escapism we'll all fall into in the Trump era. And maybe with the benefit of hindsight, we can actually tell whether or not some of these Oscars actually did mean anything or tell us anything about the future. And that's everything from what the 97 Oscars say about the Clinton years to what they resulted in. So let's all look at our Wikipedia pages of the respective Oscar years, because I don't think any of us remember of the 97 Oscars off the top of our heads.
Yeah, big year for the English Patient. Sure.
Big year for the English Patient.
Millions tuned in.
Best Picture winner I have still never seen. But Dave, maybe you've seen the English Patient, or what do you take away from looking at the 97 Oscars?
I have seen The English Patient, but that's not necessarily what I take away from the 97 Oscars. There are a lot of these movies, Fargo, Jerry Maguire to a certain extent. You got Ed Norton in Primal Fear. These are movies I return to, not necessarily because they were Oscar nominees or Oscar winners, but because I think they anchored in like a time in my film viewing. So it's like I'm looking at all these nominees, both in the 69th Academy Awards in 97 and the 79th in 2007. And I'm realizing that more than like tying the award winners to, I guess, their awards, I'm just amazed at how I tied either the argument about these award winners and nominees or the actual performances to like moments in my life. I mean, it's not so much like I wasn't fully cognizant to make the Shakespeare in Love argument, but I feel like I was more cognizant in like Departed, Letters from Iwo Jima, Little Miss Sunshine, The Queen, Babel, which was 2007.
Oh, yeah.
So I feel like I remember every single argument that I had about all of those movies.
Wait, were you arguing about these movies in 1996? Because there's a lot of these are like, you know, like I've never seen Secrets and Lies because I was pretty firm too young for that at the time.
I mean, I did. Patrick, I hadn't seen Secrets and Lies when it happened. Yeah, I don't think I saw Secrets and Lies when it happened. I do think I'd seen some of these things. So Secrets and Lies, People versus Larry Flint, I had to like catch up on. But I had definitely seen Fargo by the time this was happening.
That makes you pretty hip,
Jerry
as
Maguire.
A middle schooler.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there was something about like that particular type of violence that hadn't like started traumatizing me yet. So it was more like watching like an interesting movie with twists I wasn't expecting.
It's weird. This year's Oscars feel like, especially in the last few days when I've been peeking on Twitter as I come back to the real world, that people have been talking a lot about the politics of the Oscars. Not in terms
the
of...
politics of Oscars.
Wait, what was that to the tune to?
The politics of Oscars. Oh, she blinded me with science?
Okay.
I think, okay, yeah, wires may have been crossed there.
It sounded like, okay, whatever. Anyway, a lot of people talking about, you know, should The Salesman win Best Foreign Picture to make a statement? Or what if Moonlight won? What would that say about the Academy if Moonlight won Best Picture? And it's politics beyond, I guess, industry politics. It's about the real world repercussions of these movies winning. And I'm looking at the 69th Academy Awards from 1997. I'm like, man, there were I don't think there were politics there that people would be debating. It feels isolationist. It's all American or British films kind of sweeping every category. Not to knock Fargo or Jerry Maguire or Mike Lee.
I'm looking for my Oscar.
Oh, my God. That's what David's going to be doing. This. That's why David loves the Oscar talks, because he can just quote movies.
You just quote Jerry Maguire the whole time?
But yeah, I mean,
I can do that. I can do that without the Oscars.
True.
You know what? I think The Ghost in the Darkness winning Best Sound Effects Editing might be the first time I ever took that award seriously.
Seriously?
What? Beating Daylight.
Yeah. Well, because I had seen all three movies in that category. Lions, Sylvester Stallone, Trapped in Tube, and Arnold Schwarzenegger with the railgun.
You don't remember what tunnel Sylvester Stallone was trapped in Daylight?
I don't know, a New York tunnel.
Holland Tunnel. What? You used to live here. What happened to you?
Whatever. It all goes away really fast.
Why would you remember the Holland Tunnel of all the things you could remember leaving New York?
That's right. I didn't have a car.
I just clicked on the Wikipedia page for Daylight, a movie I did not know existed until this moment.
What?
I know, guys. I didn't start reading Entertainment Weekly until Titanic. This is right before my awakening.
But Katie, talk to me about why are people talking about politics in the Oscars as if it has any meaning? Don't these past Oscars, 1997, 2007, represent that there are no impacts made by the Oscars each year? It's kind of disappointing. You wish
on
that the
politics?
Ceremony could make.
Wait, but isn't the question
or cultural
less
repercussions?
What they change than what it is that they say about us? Because I don't know if anyone's necessarily expecting.
Well, do they change anything either? I mean, that's a big question.
I think that, you know, a movie like Moonlight winning Best Picture and sends a clear message that actually could galvanize change.
Sure.
But I also think that it's the rare film and the rare moment where that is possible, mostly because the Oscars have been so exclusive. But I think just as often the talk around them is about what they say about us and not the change that we push through them, because there are other better avenues to do that.
Well, that's what I mean. What change can they make? What films of the past have actually made that change, if any?
I mean, I wouldn't say it's about politics, but you look at Fargo, that's the presence of American independent filmmakers and the way that that kind of explosion happened in the mid-90s. And then it leads you up to Shakespeare in Love actually winning as a Miramax film. That's
Shakespeare in Love Actually? That is a movie.
Shakespeare in Love Actually. I would also watch that movie. So yeah, Fargo that year was kind of like the funky kid underdog, and Pulp Fiction had been that the year before, so you kind of watch the seeds of that being planted. You see Tom Cruise not winning an Oscar, and he still never won an Oscar, and that's fascinating.
Tom Cruise will never win an Oscar.
I'm looking for my Oscar.
I mean, this is the launch of Cuba Gooding Jr.'s career, of Billy Bob Thornton's career. You look back at Frances McDormand winning as March Gunderson. Has a Best Actress winner won for such a great role since then? Maybe not. It's that's a pretty.
She's the only person I can remember. Her she has won an Oscar. I can't remember anyone else best
Wait,
actress
winner.
You don't
remember winners. Cuba Gooding Jr. winning?
No, I remember him. No, I'm talking about the best actress category. I'm like, what movie? We had a tough time naming the best supporting actress from last year. You know, that's
best actress I can do better. You get Charlize Theron and Reese Witherspoon and Hilary Swank twice. All
Reese
the women who divorced their husbands right after.
One best
Sandra
actress
Bullock.
For Walk the Line?
She did indeed.
Wow.
That was a really weak best actress year.
Well, that's just a diss to Reese Witherspoon. Sorry, Reese.
Reese is great, but that was not a role remotely close to March Gunderson. So yeah. I don't know. I think politics will get inserted on every year, and surely someone had an argument for how The English Patient reflected the Kosovo or something like that. But
wow.
I think these are actually remarkably apolitical years, especially when you compare them to, especially with 2006, you compare it to the films from 2007. The next year, No Country for Old Men wins Best Picture. And that, I think, is pretty easy to see as a reflection of the national mood at the time.
Do you think...
Do we, we perfectly straddle, 9/11 with these, picking these 2 years.
Yeah.
We sort of, dealt with it, and then we're starting to wear off.
That's an interesting observation. That do you feel like they've mellowed? They've like normalized that entertainment can live in a vacuum in some way, or it doesn't have to be political, or the audience watching isn't as politically charged and calling for, you know, more commentary in the winners or something.
I mean, movies take so long to make that they're very rarely going to be able to actively reflect on something that's happening, but the ceremonies themselves do. I mean, just think about Michael Moore getting booed when he was making his acceptance speech for Fahrenheit 9/11. Like, that happens plenty.
Yeah, well, I'm thinking less of that and more if people see politics in our nominees this year,
are you going to talk about Oscar So White as politics? Because that is definitely there.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I will, but we wouldn't have seen that movement 20 years ago or even 10 years ago. I'm just trying to think when The Departed was up for Best Picture, you know, and there were only 5 Best Picture nominees. They were talking about the industry. And when we talk about the Academy Award this year and in the past few years, and this is a positive change, I think, we're talking about it as part of a larger landscape. We're not just talking about, like, who's putting money on Little Miss Sunshine, right?
Well,
like, there's something bigger in play now.
So, you know, the year 2006, the year before Crash, won Best Picture, and there was kind of this, you know, sarcasm about how it cured racism. But then the next year, you had a pretty remarkably diverse group of acting nominees. You've got Rinko Kikuchi and Adriana Barraza for Basil, Jennifer Hudson and Forest Whitaker both won. Like, that, and that maybe was the most diverse year until this year. I'd have to go back and look at it. So, you know, you see currents reflecting each other, even if it's not, like, about Iraq.
Yeah. I feel like this all has to do with Twitter.
Oh, my God.
I feel like Twitter launched in mid-2006.
You realize I didn't bring up this topic to talk about politics. Like, there's a lot of other things to read into this.
No, I'm talking about all conversation about the Oscars. The Oscars changed when Twitter started. Because they scrutinized at such a rapid pace, and you know the pulse of news accelerated because of Twitter. I don't know. You don't believe that?
I feel could make that a some slightly more specific statement to the Oscars, I'd be with you. But like, what did that not apply to? What you just said.
Good point.
Well, there aren't as large of events like that are summoning all our attention at this moment. In 2007, our attention was broken forever, shattered by Netflix Watch Instantly. You know, that changed the way we view. So the Academy Awards also became one of the final things that millions and millions of people watch at the same time, other than the Super Bowl. So they became an event, a cultural event that was...
Yeah, all right, let me pick that up. And yeah. So then it becomes more important for the Academy Awards to represent a greater swath of people because we're no longer just picking out things that we like out of this tiny exclusive pool of Hollywood movies, which the 90s tried to like bump up with independent film studios. Now we're trying to reflect a greater media population. I don't know if it's just Twitter, but definitely the proliferation of different types of media and like more choice for how to digest movies, I think, might have kicked off Oscars So White.
Which, and also forced the hand of the Oscars 2 years later when it went up to 10 nominees and you had things like Avatar and Education in the same category. Like, oh my God.
Well, we know what caused that, which was The Dark Knight, which came 2 years later.
That's true. It was all those people on Twitter complaining about The Dark Knight.
Go ahead, David.
It's interesting that in this Twitter culture where every shift in the wind is subject to arguments and breathless think pieces and whatnot, that at least in the last 2 years, the Best Picture winner has been... I have been assuming that La La Land wins, and maybe it won't. But certainly with Spotlight and now really for the most part La La Land, you've been able to call the Best Picture winner in September. And
you literally did and won my money for it.
I did. And I assuming that La La Land wins, it'll be another year that I called it in early September. And,
you're not making any money off me this time, Ehrlich.
I know. I'm making money off Scott Renshaw.
Oh, there you go.
But he decided at some point that our money was going to charity. And in this dark, dark world, I guess I'm going along with that. I think it's very interesting that for all of the La La Land is racist and Moonlight emergent and so on. I mean, the Moonlight narrative has been pretty fixed. Everyone just loves Moonlight and with good cause. But with all the stories going along, I mean, it's just about essentially making content because the winners have more or less been fixed. And the undercard's been scrapping away. Hacksaw Ridge getting into the conversation. Why? I don't know, but it did. And that was a sustained campaign. But really, at the top of the heap, these things have been fixed for a while.
Yeah, these.
I mean,
these,
but that might have been the case in '96. Like, we don't really know. We don't have the. Oh, we weren't there for the Twitter conversations, and those didn't exist. I don't know. Like, I'm not certain that things like inevitable frontrunners are as a result of Twitter chatter.
Well, I mean, but do you think it's easier or harder to game things because of Twitter chatter? Because before, you're just, you know, you're playing within a closed system.
Yeah, I would
now,
say it's
now, who knows who's listening to. Yeah.
I mean, if it wasn't for Twitter chatter, probably Birth of a Nation would still be in the running as
a
contender.
Well, take yourself back to 2007. What were you reading? I mean, we just get so much information about festivals and chatter in Hollywood and what people might be.
We had Entertainment Weekly.
Yeah, Entertainment Weekly was like your one source. Or
in 2007, I was reading like Awards Daily and In Contention.
Okay,
a lot of the Oscar blogs that were around then.
Yeah, I guess there was a bit more of a heated race with, like, The Departed and Little Miss Sunshine. Man.
Yeah, I mean, it was like...
How did we not see it? It was so obvious.
Oscar.
Of course The Departed was going to win.
Yeah, I mean, that kind of is, from what I remember, felt pretty obvious. I think Babel kind of made its argument in this post-crash period where it seemed like all those hyperlink movies were going to be the future.
Hyperlink.
It's funny to see that Inuyasha too, as the also-ran guy after he then came back to dominate the Oscars so much this decade.
I'm still mad about Little Miss Sunshine getting Best Original Screenplay.
Yeah.
Why?
It was because I was coming out of like being a film student, but that just reads like a note card movie to me. It's like, here's everybody's thing. Here's the three scenes where they deal with it. And then all of the dance at the end.
What would your pick have been?
What would my pick have been?
From that year.
Pan's Labyrinth.
Yeah, it's a pretty good movie.
Is it, though? Is it?
It's a good movie.
I'm talking about Best Original Screenplay category, Pan's Labyrinth.
I mean, let's remember that Children of Men lost everything, including cinematography, which is absurd.
It seems like there's more movies competing for these slots now. Like, how did Babel get into a top five
that,
an entire year?
2007's Oscars. Yeah, I think that's one of the weakest Oscar fields in history. I mean, I don't think that there's anything. I mean, it's got to be top five.
Yeah,
top
the next
10
year you get No Country and There Will Be Blood. It gets much better.
This is truly an embarrassment of embarrassment.
But I mean, I guess that says something for the 10 years of evolution we've seen in people. You know, we talk about a decline in movies and Hollywood going completely superhero and blockbuster and not caring about quality anymore. And yet I feel like we have better movies than ever.
Well, I mean, 2007 was a very, very good year for... Well, actually, this was 2006, the year...
Yeah.
2007 would be a great year for movies.
There Will Be Blood.
It was probably a good year for movies. I mean, every year is in its own way a good year for movies. It's just that the Academy may have failed us, which happens more often than not. I mean, I think it's a lot easier to... History is the story of people just looking for narratives and chaos. And I think, you know, we look at what the Oscars, this august but very limited body... picks to be the films that represent any given year, and we look back and say, like, oh, what does that say about how we live then or how we live now? And it's just what some assholes thought was the best movie of the year, and combined with the money that was spent to put them in the position for them to be picked and to be put in front of those people's
faces.
But
what I'm saying is that we're at a time when the assholes don't prevail, because the assholes aren't actually making movies that would compete at the Oscars anymore, so movies we like end up winning Oscars more often.
Well, I do want to say that's my argument about why The Salesman should win. I think The Salesman is probably the worst movie that Oscar Farhadi has ever made. I would unabashedly vote for it to win Best Foreign Film, even though Tony Erdman is superior in every way, because the Oscars don't matter. And certainly the Best Foreign Language Picture Oscar does not matter. I mean, this is the most arbitrarily determined Oscar of them all. By the time you get into the five nominees, it's just such crap. I mean, not the movies themselves necessarily, but just the process by which you got there. And nobody cares. Nobody looks back and thinks of what won Best Foreign Film. I mean, maybe the filmmakers do because it helped them get their next movie.
Hey, in the 2007 Oscars, Florian Henkel von Donnersmarck finally got off the ground.
Whatever.
So
I really don't think that Maren Ade needs an Oscar. Would it be nice to have an Amantel? Sure. But the Oscars don't fucking matter, and this Oscar really doesn't fucking matter. And in that case, why not use it as an opportunity to put something positive into the world? I think The Salesman is not a good movie. I see all these arguments on Twitter about, no, they should vote for it on merit. I would never vote for it on merit. I would absolutely vote for it, full stop. And I hope that it wins.
What else? Well, now there's Katie.
Is that what we're talking about now?
Yeah, I guess close us out with how this Oscars is going to make much bigger impact than the 79th Academy Awards or the 69th Academy Awards.
Well, what I really meant in terms of impact was in looking at where the film industry was then as opposed to where it is now, where you can see the seeds of those things starting to be born. Like, I think I talked about how the Oscars changed after 2006. You get Martin Scorsese wins his Lifetime Achievement Oscar, so he then maybe is freed up to make some more interesting stuff like Shutter Island. You have the beginning of Jennifer Hudson's career, and you know now we know the apex of it, whereas Helen Mirren has gone on to become an icon since then.
George Miller won an Oscar in 2007, thankfully.
Who did?
George Miller.
George Miller. Yeah, George Miller won an Oscar for Best Animated Feature, and then comes back with Mad Max. Like, who could have seen that coming?
Well, actually, he came back with Happy Feet 2, and then he came back
that's
with
true.
Mad Max.
I don't know if Happy Feet 2 got nominated for an
Happy
Oscar.
Feet 2, where Brad Pitt and Matt Damon play shrimp.
Yes. You have Eddie Murphy losing the Best Supporting Actor award to Alan Arkin. Like, what if he'd won? His career could be so much more interesting than it is now. So that's the kind of stuff that I like looking back at. And, you know, for this year, we don't know. Like, is Damien Chazelle going to become this, you know, stalwart Hollywood director? I think he's going to win Best Director, which should really set him up for a great career. But who knows what he's going to do from there? Emma Stone's likely to win. Then, you know, she's got that Oscar. So then she go back and make straight comedies because she's really good at that. Yeah, it's kind of, you watch like the beginning of stories start to play themselves out.
I suppose if Casey Affleck loses, then people can look at it as a victory for calling out people who
protesting and campaigning against him.
Yeah.
Well, no, yeah, I mean, look at a victory for
justice.
People paying a price, yeah, and so on. I mean, I think that there are narratives yet to be told that are decided at the actual Oscar ceremony, but. When we look back, I mean, maybe these stories, we are all relatively young people who are not as with it in the sense as we were, back then. Maybe there were these stories swirling around, not quite the Casey Affleck narrative, but some other stories swirling around the Oscar winners of 1997.
Definitely.
That we just don't remember.
Yeah, I mean, I think Billy Bob Thornton.
You guys remember when Diane Keaton, like, dissected her puppy that one time because she took so much meth. That was like the big thing in 96.
Never forget that People magazine spread.
Yeah, I remember the thought that Lauren McCall might win for A Mirror Has Two Faces because it would be like a Lifetime Achievement thing, and then Juliette Binoche won, and now people are kind of relieved they didn't give it to Lauren McCall for a not very good movie. Joan Allen could have won an Oscar then. She didn't.
Jeffrey Rush won an Oscar for Shine so that 20 years later he could make a movie that David would describe as kind of like Shine.
And he's in that Einstein show Nat Geo that looks kind of good. There's all of this stuff kind of emerges and you don't know the story of it until maybe 10 years later, which is what I think is interesting about looking back at this stuff. I do think after this year, we're going to get pretty strong overdue narratives for Michelle Williams and Ryan Gosling, who are both likely to lose. And then, of course, there's the whole Amy Adams of it. After she got snubbed this year, I think her next anything eligible for Oscar is going to win.
I hope so. I love
her.
Yeah. No, and
well, I hope it's a good
although
movie.
The and next thing she's doing is a Jean-Marc Vallée TV show. So,
oh, really?
Her Oscar will have to wait.
Wait, isn't he also doing Big Little Lies?
Yes. Or he did two TV shows.
He's doing another one?
He's doing where Big Little he's Lies. Working where he belongs, I think.
Jesus. The first hour of Big Little Lies is rough.
We're going to have to talk about that later. I definitely want to talk about that show. Yeah, I don't know when Amy Adams is going to get her due. I hope soon.
She will. I think this Arrival snub is just going to really lead to... I mean, it's like when Kate Winslet won for The Reader, which is not a good movie at all, but there was so much will to give her an Oscar that everyone just did it.
It's also a movie that you just completely made up, so...
Exactly.
She went for that.
Yeah. What did she win for, David?
I don't know, but...
not The Reader.
It must not have been a real movie, I would imagine.
So we'll all be watching the Oscars on Sunday. I won't be on our Oscar recap episode because I'll be recovering from having been at the Vanity Fair party. But presumably you'll all be watching and tweeted us about, I don't know, whatever you think the narrative will be in 20 years. If any of us or the country survive that long.
Downer.
Drink every time someone makes a joke about it being the last Oscars.
Well, actually, I watched the opening of the WGA Awards.
Didn't Patton Oswalt make that joke?
And he made that. Welcome to the last WGA Awards, which I thought was fun. I'll always laugh at it, I guess.
The media is the enemy of the American people.
Who's hosting? Jimmy Kimmel?
Jimmy Kimmel.
Oof.
I mean, he won't throw away a shot, as one might say.
Still don't get it.
That does it for this week's Fighting in the War Room. Like I said, we'll be back next week. I won't be here. I'll be recovering from the Oscars, but, you know, I'll tweet my opinions or whatever. But anyway, in the meantime, please leave us reviews, enter our contest, keep talking to us, and everybody else, tell the people who you are.
I am Matt Patches. I'm the senior entertainment editor of Thrillist.com. I'm on Twitter at Mr. Patches. We have a website, fightinginthewarroom.com, where you can listen to the episodes, you can share them, you can leave comments that we'll probably read if you actually leave them. So go to fightinginthewarroom.com and yeah, sign up for our contest on iTunes. 3 bundles, giving them away.
I'm David Ehrlich. I'm the senior film critic for IndieWire. You can find my articles about the Berlin Film Festival on IndieWire. You can find me taking my life in my hands, writing an article this week, I think, about why I really like La La Land. And you can find me on Twitter at David Ehrlich. You can find all of us together on Facebook at Fighting in the War Room.
I'm Dave Gonzalez. You can find me on Twitter at DA7E. You can find me online at various places that I'll link to off my Twitter. You can find all my podcasts at fightinginthewarroom.com, including Storm of Spoilers, which we'll be doing our first live show at South by Southwest
next
month.
What?
I get to take 3 Joanna Robinson vacations this year. 2 because of Storm of Spoilers live shows.
That is fantastic.
It's going to be happening. Come out and see what we look like. It'll be the first time we all see each other in the physical space.
Wow. I'm Kitty Rich. I'm at vanityfair.com, where we'll be doing a live stream from the Oscar party on Sunday. So after the awards are over, tune in to us on the Vanity Fair Facebook page and various other places. I will tweet it. And watch me in formal wear with my boss, Mike Hogan, and various other people talking about the awards themselves. It's going to be interesting. It's the first time we're doing it, but you know, what can go so wrong? And also, you can find me on Twitter, where I'll tweet a link to that and whatever else I've got going on. And you can find all of us on Twitter at FITWR, where we love talking to you. And you can answer this week's lightning round question, which was,
in honor of Get Out, what is the tensest you felt in a movie during a specific moment?
Thank you for listening, and we'll be back, or they will be back, talking to you next week.